Why is Diane on my mind? A conversation with MSNBC's Joe Scarborough. With the formal transition of power finally underway, President-elect Joe Biden can now access the reins of government as he prepares to step into the White House in January. But Donald Trump has not conceded and may never do so. My guest, Joe Scarborough, is looking to our country's 33rd president, Harry Truman, can offer lessons to Joe Biden on this rocky transition. Truman's foreign policy helped create the American century, a vision Trump used his 4 years to reject. Scarborough's new book is titled Saving Freedom, Truman, the Cold War, and the Fight for Western Civilization. I spoke to him Tuesday morning. Joe, in your new book, Saving Freedom, you tell the story of how a very unlikely president, Harry Truman, shaped our modern world and, in the words of Winston Churchill, more than any other man, saved civilization. But right as we're having this conversation, we've got another man in the White House who seems determined to do everything he can to do exactly the opposite. What do you make of this guy?
I think we've all come to expect what we've come to expect from Donald Trump. For me, what remains even more disappointing, shocking, and I think challenging for this country has been what my former colleagues, men and women that I served with in the United States Congress when I was a young Republican representing Northwest Florida, I'm absolutely stunned that they have remained silent while the President of the United States behaved the way he did over the past 4 years, breached constitutional norms, breached political norms, caged children as a matter of policy, went around bragging about having unlimited powers through Article 2 of the Constitution, and even at the end of the campaign, as if COVID wasn't enough and his mistreatment of COVID, the fact that he was calling for his attorney general to arrest his political competitor, that is something that we hear out of Russia, that's something we hear out of Venezuela, that's something we hear out of Belarus, but not the United States of America. And yet, my former Republican colleagues remain silent.
Why? Why do you suppose that is? I mean, the Mitch McConnells of this world. Why?
I do not know. Because you and I have been around Washington long enough to know what I always tell presidents or administrations when they're coming in, which is this: you think you own the White House, you're only renting it, make the best of your time, but understand you're going to be gone in an instant. And that's the same thing with power in Washington, D.C. I mean, even Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader right now, he'll be leaving soon enough. He will have a legacy to worry about. And does he really want to be remembered, as I think he will be, as a Senate Majority Leader who knew better, but enabled a man with autocratic instincts who's moved the Republican Party to actually a post-democracy party where election results don't matter?
So now it seems to be over with the letter sent to Joe Biden by Emily Murphy of the GSA, finally giving him the power and the authority he needs to move forward with the transition. She really worded that letter very carefully, saying she was making her own decision independently and had not been pressured by anyone in the White House at any level. contradicted almost immediately by the president himself, who said he gave her permission to do this. What did you make of that?
I don't think she was going to move until she did get some sort of sign off. I think the administration understood, and finally Donald Trump understood, that Rudy Giuliani was doing far more damage, far more harm to him than good. It became an embarrassing spectacle, and he was starting to see people on Fox News and the Wall Street Journal editorial page start to say that. And then he started seeing CEOs yesterday. I thought that was significant. And even Steve Schwarzman, who, of course, is the CEO of BlackRock, who had been surprising to me because I knew Steve in a past life, had been one of his strong supporters. So when he started breaking away and others started breaking away, I think Donald Trump understood that he needed to begin this transition. It's what people inside and outside of the White House had been suggesting that he do. But again, you look at Ms. Murphy, you look at the head of the GSA. She has a duty not to the President of the United States. She has a duty to the Constitution of the United States of America. And the fact that she refused to begin this process, even though she knew Joe Biden was going to be the next president of the United States, even though we all knew he was going to be the next president of the United States, again shows just, unfortunately, how frayed constitutional norms and political norms have become in the age of Trump. And I am just hoping we will all look back on this as a one-off, as a one-time occurrence, because it certainly is deeply, deeply troubling to me. And actually, I hope we pass quite a few reforms in the coming years to actually limit what the president's discretion in some of these areas.
Do you think that Trump was seriously trying to conduct a coup?
I think Donald Trump was seriously trying to overturn the results of the election. As he always does, he pushes the boundaries. He goes as far as he can go. There's a reason why he said he had unlimited powers under Article 2. There was a reason why he said it was his Justice Department and he could charge whoever he wanted to charge. There was a reason why he said he could fire Bob Mueller. But in each case, he didn't do that because right as the system was pressed to its breaking point, he would get pushback. And I think the final pushback for him came in the form of the Michigan legislators who he brought to the White House, hoping to persuade them to give him Michigan's electoral votes, regardless of the fact that he lost by over 100,000 votes in the state of Michigan. And then yesterday, the certification of Joe Biden winning the state of Michigan. But yes, I think Donald Trump will get away with whatever Donald Trump can get away with. And we're just fortunate, I think more than anything over these past 4 years, that we have a strong federal judiciary that has time and time again checked his worst instincts.
David Rothkopf was on his podcast just recently. He has called Donald Trump a traitor to the United States. He compared him with the worst of the worst, with Benedict Arnold, among others. Do you take that kind of language seriously?
Well, it's not a word that I would use yet. I will say if this had continued another week or two, and if Donald Trump continued to stage a coup against a president-elect who had received 80 million votes, then I think we would have to start looking at possible crimes. There was, I don't know if you remember, but in the 60s, I think it was the Birchers, but there was some far right-wing group that wrote and bought up a lot of books called None Dare Call It Treason. And then, of course, the book explains how the elites in Washington were guilty of treason. That's sort of what I continue to say over the past several months. None dare call it treason. But at some point, if he had continued moving to delegitimize American democracy and overturn the votes of 80 million Americans, then yeah, I think if he had pushed it further and moved more people in the direction, then I think you'd have to start looking at statutes and also looking at seeing if his activity was in fact treasonous.
In his tweet following the GSA letter, he said, "We will fight on." Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
It means nothing to me. What that means is he knows that all escape routes have been shut down. He understands that Rudy Giuliani, who sold him a bill of goods on this, has once again embarrassed Rudy Giuliani and also embarrassed Donald Trump. And he does this all the time. He's always looking for somebody to blame. And right now he's blaming Rudy Giuliani for making a fool of himself and by extension, making a fool of the President of the United States.
Joe, talk about the apparent GOP civil war we're seeing in Georgia right now.
Well, you know, everybody thinks that Mitch McConnell is this three-dimensional chess player. I'm not so sure. When it comes to Georgia, it looks like McConnell is actually eating the chess pieces because you have Republicans attacking Republicans. You have the two candidates, Perdue and Loeffler, attacking the Republican Secretary of State. You have the president's team now attacking the Republican governor of the state, who always was one of Trump's most loyal lackeys. So to suddenly suggest he's part of some George Soros-inspired plot is absolutely ridiculous. And then, I mean, they continue shooting themselves in the foot. And then just a few days ago, Sidney Powell, who, of course, had been side by side with Rudy Giuliani and the president's legal team over the past several weeks, started talking about how Governor Kemp, the Republican governor in Georgia, had actually been part of a conspiracy that rigged Kelly Loeffler's election and put her in the runoff instead of Doug Collins. So there are a lot of bizarre machinations going on in the Republican Party in Georgia. None of them good for the two candidates that are running in the special election in early January. So I'm just wondering when Mitch McConnell is going to call it a day, tell the president that he's lost, and start focusing on those elections and stop with the conspiracy theories about Hugo Chavez and George Soros.
So what do you see as the future of the Republican Party considering all these machinations?
I really don't know. I've always been skeptical that Trumpism would survive Donald Trump. When a cult leader dies, the cult usually dies. And if you want to just look at recent political history, well, over the past 30, 40 years, everybody believed that Ronald Reagan had created a new lasting Republican coalition. It was enough to carry George H.W. Bush over the finish line in 1988, but of course, Bill Clinton and the Democrats won in 1992, and Democrats have won the popular vote, let's see, in 92, 96, 2000, 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020. So, I mean, Republicans have won the popular vote two times since 1988. So much for the grand Reagan coalition. We also heard about the Obama coalition and the coalition of the ascendant, which of course was not transferable from Barack Obama to Hillary Clinton, was not even transferable from Barack Obama to his former vice president, Joe Biden. Joe Biden won, but he certainly didn't carry parts of the electorate the way that Barack Obama did. Black voters, Latino voters. Biden held his own, did as well as Hillary Clinton did, almost as well as Hillary Clinton did with those parts of the coalition. But what made the difference for Biden in the end were white voters in the suburbs disgusted by Donald Trump, who abandoned the Republican Party. So again, I don't think the Trump coalition survives Trump. It's certainly Don Jr. is not going to be able to carry it forward. Ivanka is not going to be carrying it forward. And people who think that they would be able to do that are kidding themselves.
Do you think Donald Trump will ever go to jail?
I think it's far more likely that he will be arrested than it is likely he will run for president again in 2024. I suspect that the prosecutors in Manhattan and in the state of New York want to bring charges against him, but probably do not want him on the stand, do not want a former president on the stand. So I would expect a lot of plea deals to be offered and most likely made. But I don't think the Attorney General of the state of New York is going away.
Let's talk about Harry Truman. You call him the most consequential foreign policy president the last 75 years. Talk about why.
Well, Harry Truman came into office as a man that I think very few expected greatness from. He had been underestimated his entire life. When he wanted to run for office, old political machine he was a part of in 1934, wouldn't let him run for Senate. But after the first four people they selected decided not to run, they let Truman run. He won in an upset victory. He worked for FDR and the New Deal, was one of its most ardent supporters over the next 6 years. But in 1940, FDR wouldn't even endorse him, would not campaign for him. Truman won again in another upset. And then 4 years later, FDR and his cabinet understood they had a real problem with Henry Wallace, a guy that was too far left and too close to the Soviet Union to be vice president of the United States, when they were concerned that FDR probably wouldn't survive his fourth term. So they selected Harry Truman, but even FDR's own chief of staff, when somebody brought up Truman's name, he said, "Who the hell is Harry Truman?" Time magazine called him a rube and a funny little man. But he got elected, and he got elected. You know, we've seen Donald Trump keep information from Joe Biden over the past several weeks that he desperately needs to prepare for his new administration. But FDR did something, I think, possibly worse. He kept all information from Harry Truman, that all relevant information. So they'd only met two times in office in their 3 months. And after his first cabinet meeting, it was Secretary Stimson who asked the new president, Harry Truman, "Hey, can we have a word in private?" and told him about the Manhattan Project. And Truman was absolutely shocked, had no idea this program was going on, despite the fact that he had run the Truman Committee and knew an awful lot about defense. But he was completely blindsided by it all. And yet, despite that, with the help of an extraordinary cabinet with George Marshall and Dean Acheson, George Kennan, Everell Harriman, who was his ambassador to the Soviet Union, he created a foreign policy construct that has really shaped, it created the American century, but really shaped everything that happened over the past 70 years. Every president, the 12 presidents that followed, Republican or Democrat alike, they walked around the world stage on a stage that was constructed and built, designed by Harry Truman. And that is really extraordinary for a man who, just a dozen years before he became commander-in-chief and learned about the Manhattan Project, was a county administrator in Jackson County, Missouri, worrying about roads and making payroll.
So talk about the challenges Truman faced at the end of the Second World War.
So Truman came in April of 1945. They were still fighting a war in Europe and in the Pacific. And Truman had to bring those two wars to an end. He also had to make the fateful decision on whether to drop atomic bombs on Japanese cities until they surrendered, deciding that millions of lives would be saved if he did drop those bombs. And then it was critically important for him to rebuild Europe, because a continent that was starving to death, a continent with millions of refugees, a continent whose industrial base had been completely shattered and taken to the ground by bombing and this massive war, was ripe for Stalin and communism. And so Truman had to move quickly. And I thought it spoke well of Truman that one of the first people he reached out to in rebuilding Europe was actually Herbert Hoover, who, of course, had been FDR's predecessor, a man who was considered a colossal failure as a president, a man that Democrats were campaigned against every 2 years after he left office. But Truman knew that it had been Hoover who had helped the post-World War I refugee crisis and helped to feed Europe after the First World War I, and was an extraordinary engineer and had a great mind. And so he called Herbert Hoover in, and Hoover was suspicious, thought that he was being set up to once again be a Democratic president's punching bag. But they eventually figured out that they had to work together to bring this about. Truman put Hoover in charge of that refugee crisis. And Michael Duffy, who wrote The President's Club, along with Nancy Gibbs, said that those two gentlemen ended up saving more lives in Europe than anybody else by just that action. But then he began working with the Republicans in Congress. Chairman Arthur Vandenberg, who had been an avowed isolationist from Michigan, and they began working on the Truman Doctrine. They began working on the Marshall Plan. They began working on NATO and doing these things that rebuilt Europe at a time when Europe's future was not a preordained thing. It was a continent that had been completely shattered, blown to pieces. And as my book, first chapter of my book begins, we had thought we would be sharing that burden, that responsibility with the British Empire, with Great Britain. And the opening scene of my book has Dean Acheson receiving two notes from the British ambassador saying, "We can't do this anymore. We are an exhausted empire. We are an exhausted country. And if Greece and Turkey are to be saved, they will be saved by your hand and not ours." So a lot of things in Harry Truman's inbox. Churchill was right. Western civilization did depend on him making the right calls. And with the help of some extraordinarily talented, wise men around him, he did just that.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Joe Scarborough. Here is the rest of my conversation with Joe Scarborough, host of MSNBC's Morning Joe. His new book is titled Saving Freedom, Truman, the Cold War, and the Fight for Western Civilization. I want to take you back. You've done so much research for this book. Take us back to that controversial decision, still controversial, of dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. Did he need to do that to bring the war to an end when apparently the Emperor of Japan was already ready to concede?
You know, if you certainly look at history and you look at certainly the sources that I read, and you also compare the conventional bombing, the deaths that had occurred from conventional bombings, not just in Japan, not just in Tokyo, but also our firebombing of Dresden and other German cities, and in some cases, I think unnecessarily, after there was no doubt who was going to win the war. You see that actually more civilians were being killed by conventional bombs than actually died by these atomic bombs. And for Harry Truman, the calculus at the time was that 1 million Americans could die with the invasion going into Japan, as many or more Japanese could die in that invasion as well, and the war could go in late 1946, 1947. And so it's very interesting. The further I get away from the topic, the more I go back to my default, which is raising the question, wait, why did he have to do that? Why did we have to do that? And when I get closer to it and closer to the information that Harry Truman had at the time and our leaders in Washington had at the time, it actually does seem like a decision that made the most sense if you just look at how the war could be ended the most quickly and how the most lives could be saved. But I suspect, for very good reason, it's a debate that will be going on 100 years from now.
Probably so. You write in your book that the irony of the Truman Doctrine is that it was fashioned as a means of resistance against the spread of Soviet communism, but it really wasn't such a threat.
Well, there was in Turkey a great concern, and in Greece a great concern at the time when Truman was passing the Truman Doctrine and the United States was getting involved. By the time Stalin recognized that we had a laser-like focus on those two countries, by the time the Greeks won the civil war against the communists, Stalin had already decided he was not going to get involved, that he had enough concerns in Central Europe, had enough concerns possibly in parts of Western Europe, that he was not going to interfere in the affairs of Greece or Turkey. There's another interesting thing, though, about Greece, because if you move the Truman Doctrine forward, obviously you move it forward and the application of it eventually led to the tragedy of Vietnam, where you had JFK, LBJ, and then Richard Nixon, all three saying, and you heard the tapes in Ken Burns' wonderful PBS documentary on Vietnam, one of the best documentaries I've ever seen in my life, where all three of those presidents said, we can't win there, but I can't be seen as the person losing Vietnam. And it kept them in a stalemate while 57,000 Americans were killed and 2 million Vietnamese civilians and enemy combatants were killed. But that was the framework that the Truman Doctrine left in place. Of course, I'm writing about how it kept Stalin out of Western Europe and how it eventually led to us winning the Cold War. But there were mistakes in just how rigidly it had been implemented from time to time. And in Vietnam, we didn't really understand until much later that for the North Vietnamese, it was a war of nationalism. They were tired of the French being in there. They didn't want the United States being in there. And we had leaders, Democrats and Republicans alike, who thought that this was a war against communism. And in fact, it was not that to the North Vietnamese. It was a war of liberation for them. But you know, even going back to Greece, I think it's very telling that when Harry Truman went to Congress and was talking to reluctant Republicans in Congress, isolationist Republicans, and also reluctant progressives, one of their concerns had to do with the nature of the Greek government. They were a brutal right-wing government. So Truman had to be very straightforward and say, it's along the lines of what Henry Kissinger would much later say about foreign policy. You never have the choice between good and evil, it seems. You never have the choice between right and wrong. It always seems to be choosing between two bad choices and choosing the lesser of the two evils. Well, in Greece, that's what Harry Truman was confronting in 1947 and had to tell Democrats and Republicans alike. We have a right-wing government in Greece that needs to be reformed, and we'll put pressure on them to reform them. But make no mistake, they are not angels. They're obviously a better alternative than Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union, but not by much. And so we're going to have to work to reform that. And it's what our diplomats put pressure on Greece repeatedly to make sure that that would happen.
The Truman Doctrine hasn't been without some downsides, most especially the Korean War.
Right, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. It's interesting that during Greece and Turkey, during that debate for the initial debate over the Truman Doctrine, many Republicans and progressives on the Democratic side were saying, "Wait, we have the United Nations. Why aren't the United Nations getting involved in this?" And it was the reason why Truman and George Marshall and Atchison didn't think the United Nations could do this is because they couldn't move quickly enough because the crisis, the British believed the crisis was pressing. So when Korea came along, we actually did get the United Nations more actively involved, but they were involved more in name than anything else. And as you said, it's one more example of where just sort of this blind application of the Truman Doctrine without understanding the realities on the ground obviously could lead to tragedy, military stalemates, the frustration of Americans. That certainly happened in the Korean War and happened again in the Vietnam War.
So bringing us forward to today, to what extent do you think that we as a nation are backing away and will continue to do so from responsibility for the peace in other nations?
Well, I do think that Americans, after 75, 80 years, are ready to ensure that America is not the, as people say, the policeman of the world. At the same time, we have international organizations that Harry Truman put in place with NATO, with the United Nations, and whatever we do, we should do it in concert with these international institutions. I'm pleased with some of Joe Biden's selections so far. They are internationalists. They're liberal internationalists. They believe the United States has a role in the world, not a role as a dominant force, but as a partner to NATO, a partner to our alliances in Asia and across the world. So it really is a balancing act. We can't retreat from the world like Donald Trump and a lot of Republicans want us to do. But at the same time, we can't guarantee freedom on all four corners of the globe as the neocons and George W. Bush had said in his second inaugural address he wanted to do. So it's a balancing act, and I'm hopeful that Secretary of State Tony Blinken and the rest of Joe Biden's cabinet will be able to strike that balance. I'm pretty confident they will.
So considering the choices that Joe Biden has already made, including Tony Blinken, and especially, I must say, John Kerry, as special envoy for the environment, are you optimistic that much of the downside of the last 4 years can somehow be corrected?
I am very optimistic. I'm optimistic about Tony's selection as Secretary of State. I think he'll be a wonderful Secretary of State. I think John Kerry being a special envoy on the environment is so important. I think a lot of Republicans, but I also think people in the media sometimes don't understand just how out of step we are with the rest of the world when it comes to climate change. It's very interesting when Boris Johnson congratulated Joe Biden, and he did so fairly early. I think he may have done it the day or two after Biden was declared the winner by the media. What did he talk about cooperating with Joe Biden on? Climate change. And that's, of course, a very conservative leader in Great Britain. So I look forward to the United States getting involved again in the Paris Accords. I look forward to the United States again taking a leadership role across the globe on the environment. There's this either or trap that it seems Republicans want to set Democrats up with, and saying you're either for the environment or you're for a strong economy. Well, Bill Clinton campaigned in 1992 and again in 1996 saying, that's a false choice. You can be for a strong economy and for a clean environment. And I think that's the balance that we again have to strike. And what I've always found with CEOs, what I've always found with business leaders is this. If you go to them and you talk to them about environmental standards and say, this is what we need to do, and you set a roadmap for the next 10, 15 years, then they'll adjust to that. They can plan around that. What they can't plan around is retooling for a Republican administration and then having to retool for a Democratic administration and then having to retool for a Republican administration. We need some constancy, and I certainly hope over the next 4 years, Americans, and yes, even Republicans, will take a more unified stand on climate change, understanding that just like COVID, science is science, and it does no good to deny science. It does no good to deny basic medicine. It does no good to deny basic facts. That's what the Republicans have been doing, and something they need to move past.
But working with Mitch McConnell in the leadership, how easy or difficult is it going to be for Joe Biden to get some really important things done, not only on the environment, but on health care, on minimum wage, on issues so important to the American people?
Well, you know, while our media landscape has become more divided, while politics seems to have become more divided in America, there is a growing center in the United States Senate. You don't see that in the House because it's so gerrymandered that you have people on the far left and the far right, unfortunately, in many cases. But in the Senate, think about the fact that Mark Kelly just got elected from the Republican state of Arizona. Kristen Sinema 2 years ago got elected in that same state. This is the first time Democrats have had both Senate seats. My gosh, probably ever. But they're still in a fairly conservative state. So there are two moderate Democrats that Joe Biden can look to. You also have in Colorado, Governor Hickenlooper, who is also going to be a moderate force on the Republican side. You have Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and yes, Susan Collins, who has already said and shown early on after getting reelected that she was going to try to strike more of a middle ground that she used to strike. So there's six. I haven't even brought up Joe Manchin, who's pretty conservative Democrat. So there are six, seven Republicans and Democrats alike that really are filling in a middle ground between the left and the right of the United States Senate. And if you have a Republican Party that has a one-vote majority, Mitch McConnell is going to have to deal with Joe Biden, just like Joe Biden's going to have to deal with Mitch McConnell. And I think most of the action is going to be getting those six, seven Republicans and Democrats alike to come together for healthcare reform, for a plan on the environment, for a plan on minimum wage, for a plan on a lot of the issues that you were talking about.
You ran as a Republican. Are you still a Republican?
No. I'll say the Republican Party left me in 2017, but I left the Republican Party. But, you know, even in December of 2015, after Donald Trump had a press conference post-Paris, the ISIS attacks on Paris, he had a press conference where he started talking about a Muslim registry. And I said to my audience at the time, I said, this is what Germany looked like in the early 1930s. I could never vote for this man. This man should not be the person who's leading the Republican Party. I will never support this man. It's interesting that as we moved forward. More and more Republicans embraced Donald Trump. The more outrageous he became when he attacked a judge because he was Hispanic, saying he couldn't trust him because he was Hispanic. They stayed with him when he attacked a Gold Star family because the American hero who died happened to be a man who loved his country and was Muslim. They stayed with him. They stayed with him through Charlottesville. They stayed with him through the caging of children as an announced policy. They stayed with him through COVID, him lying to Americans while 250,000 plus Americans died. And like I said, they stayed with him when he was calling for the arrest of his political opponent. And even over the past couple of weeks. So no, I don't know if I'm going to remain an independent. I don't know if I'm going to become a conservative Democrat. I just know one thing. I will never be a Republican again. I just can't.
And one last question. How will you and Mika spend Thanksgiving?
Very carefully. We Mika's mom lives right around the corner with us. And I've got four children, but two of those children have underlying conditions. One is a diabetic, and the other, though he's a very tall, strong, healthy kid, he's got asthma, which he hasn't grown out of yet. So we've been very careful. We've isolated for most of this COVID crisis, and we'll continue to do that. We'll stay at home. We'll have our children around. We'll have Mika's mom around. But we will save the traveling till 2021. What about you? What plans do you have?
I'm staying right here in my condo, and I'm cooking the turkey.
It'll be fun. It'll be fun. And you'll have your, I see a dog in the background, right?
Yeah, my little dog. Do you want to see her?
Yes. Hey, can you see if Mika's available? I've got Mika here who loves dogs. Oh!
She is a two-year-old Havanese poodle.
Oh, she is so cute.
Well, she is the dearest dog I've ever had in my life. She weighs 11 pounds, and that's it.
Oh.
She's just wonderful.
Oh, my gosh. So I have a guest here. Mika, come here. It's Diane.
Oh, Mika.
I saw a dog in the background. Mika is an animal person.
Is that a Havanese?
Havanese poodle.
I have one.
Same thing.
Yeah, well, I have the exact dog, looks just like yours, but we rescued it from the animal shelter in Baltimore. And they are the most lovely animals.
They're unbelievable.
He is just the dearest dog. My husband gave her to me as a wedding gift. It's wonderful to see you. I want to wish you both just a wonderful Thanksgiving with your family.
Thank you.
You too.
With all of our animals.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you having us on the show.
Thank you, Joe. Take good care.
Okay, you too. Happy Thanksgiving.
Bye-bye. That was Joe Scarborough, host of MSNBC's Morning Joe. His new book is titled Saving Freedom, Truman, the Cold War, and the Fight for Western Civilization. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written to let me know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Thanks for listening, all. I want to wish you a wonderful and safe Thanksgiving. I'm Diane Reen.